Welcome to the Aronoff Report, where our host provides essential commentary and in-depth interviews with people in the know on politics, current events, and national security issues. He is the Executive Director of the Citizens Commission on National Security. And now your host, Roger Aronoff.
Welcome to the Aronoff Report. I am Roger Aronoff, the Executive Director and Editor of the Citizens Commission on National Security. We are a nonprofit organization founded last year as a national security watchdog organization. While editor of Accuracy in Media, I had started the Citizens Commission on Benghazi, which you can read all about on our website, which is ccnationalsecurity.org. That's CC for Citizens Commission. nationalsecurity.org. We came together to do our own investigation and publicize our findings about Benghazi, who was a group of retired admirals, generals, other high-ranking former military people, CIA officers, and congressmen who all wanted to continue our work after Benghazi, but applying it to other national security topics. So we have formed a new independent organization with mostly the same members. Today on the Aronoff Report, we have two great guests, both journalists who are busy covering major stories around the world. First, I will be talking with Claudia Rosette, who is currently in Hong Kong covering the protests and demonstrations that have been taking place since March, but grew to massive numbers starting in June. And later, I will be speaking with Melanie Phillips, a British journalist who was in Israel last week for the elections, which were inconclusive and are still unfolding at this time. Claudia, welcome to the Aronoff Report.
Thank you very much. Glad to be here.
Great to have you. Well, let me tell our listeners about you. You are a foreign policy fellow at the Independent Women's Forum, a former international journalist with the Wall Street Journal. You still write for them on a freelance basis, and the author of the book, What to Do About the UN. Her work can also be found at the Rosette Report at pajamasmedia.com. Ms. Rosette writes on international affairs, drawing on over 35 years of experience as a journalist and editor, reporting from Asia, the former Soviet Union, Latin America, and the Middle East. She exposed the UN oil for food scandal, then the largest financial fraud in history, and she appeared before four U.S. House committees and subcommittees to testify on UN-related corruption. Her work on oil for food earned Claudia the 2005 Eric Brendel Award. She served as a member of the Wall Street Journal's editorial board in New York from 1997 to 2002. As a reporter and then bureau chief of the Wall Street Journal's Moscow Bureau, covering the former Soviet Union, and as an editorial page editor of the Asian Wall Street Journal from 1986 to 1993. From 2003 to 2015, she was journalist in residence with the Foundation for Defense of Democracies. Her on-site coverage of China's 1989 Tiananmen Square uprising won Ms. Rosette an Overseas Press Club citation for excellence. And I think we'll cut it off there. It could go on, but quite an amazing career, Claudia.
Thank you.
These protests started over the introduction of anti-extradition law proposed by the Hong Kong government. And in a Wall Street Journal article earlier this month, you wrote that, quote, in vital respects, it is the same showdown as Tiananmen Square in 1989 Beijing. China's dictatorship is once again losing control of a major city to people whose rallying cry is freedom. Rather than give in to their legitimate demands, the Communist Party is readying its guns. So how is this the same and how is it different from what happened in Beijing 30 years ago?
Well, let me just quickly do some of the obvious large differences. Okay. Hong Kong is a wealthy, developed city with a very cosmopolitan population that understands quite well the sort of the functions of democracy and is richly, you know, prepared to, there's sort of a democracy looking for a place to reside right now because they can't live in their own institutions. Those are inhabited by puppets of Beijing. But and Beijing in 30 years ago in 1989 was the capital of a very poor China, impoverished by its own long experiment with Mao's communism. And it was really an unusual chance to see, to look into China. It ended up on television because Mikhail Gorbachev had just been to visit and all this international TV press was there. I went up there from Hong Kong, where I was then based, like a lot of people in the Asian press corps. You know, there are all sorts of differences in the sense that Beijing is the capital of China. Hong Kong is a territory that was handed to China by the British, a former colony, with the promise that China made, as President Trump alluded to at the UN, I mean, it doesn't allude to, he mentioned specifically in his speech on Tuesday at the UN, with China promising that for 50 years it would respect the rights and freedoms in Hong Kong. So in Beijing, they had no rights. They had nothing. They were protesting, asking for democracy and a say in their own government. In Hong Kong, they have had a lot, and China has been taking it away. It wasn't supposed to, but that's what it's doing. It's been encroaching on the freedoms that they had. It has failed to honor its promise that they would get universal suffrage to be able to elect their own leader. 5 years ago, it took that away and put in a system where Beijing decides who is the chief executive here. But in both cases, and here's where it's the same, it's the same showdown of people living under the flag of the People's Republic of China who are saying, we don't want to be ruled by tyranny. We want a say in our own government. We want to choose our leaders. We want a system where our voices count. We want to be a free people, basically. It's the same in that sense, and it's the same in the sense that the response of the Communist Party of China, which was in power 30 years ago, which is celebrating 70 years in power next Tuesday, has been, in both cases, basically to say, no, you can't have that. In 1989, they said it by murdering their own citizens in the streets of their own capital. And in Hong Kong, they've been saying it with this blank refusal to give back anything, to do anything, to compromise by leaving it to their puppet chief executive here, Carrie Lam, and the Hong Kong police force so far to basically, under the name of enforcing law, try to stop protests while China has been threatening that it would use military action. So that's kind of the differences in the same. Basically, it's between a struggle between freedom and tyranny, and we're seeing this all over again.
Right. So you mentioned Trump's UN speech. What he actually said, here's the quote, "The world fully expects that the Chinese government will honor its binding treaty made with the British and registered with the United Nations, which commits China to protect Hong Kong's freedom, legal system, and democratic ways of life. How China chooses to handle the situation will say a great deal about its role in the world and the future." Do you think that Trump is showing enough support to the people fighting to be free in Hong Kong?
He's starting to. I'd love to hear even more. I think the more explicit he makes it, the better. You know, there's a school of thinking that says he should be diplomatic and nuanced and try at all costs not to offend the government of China. Well, the government of China is offended by anything that suggests that they shouldn't Xi Jinping, the president of China, and his cohorts or his flunkies should not enjoy absolute power. And if you start deferring to that, it's bottomless. So I think the clearer the United States can make it that China will not, if they choose to do something terrible here, or if they choose to keep grinding it down, that they will not be allowed to do that with impunity, that something will be done by the United States, preferably by the entire free world, to exact a price that China really will not like to pay.
Give us a sense of what it was like standing with a crowd of 2 million people. I don't know if you were there that day or the days that they got to those kind of numbers, but
yeah, I wasn't there for that. Was in June, and this what triggered this was, remember that the chief executive introduced a bill that would have allowed extradition from Hong Kong to China, where in China it can be a crime to do things that in a free society are normal, such as criticize the leadership. And Hong Kong's people understand that very well. And that was when first 1 million people marched against it. The chief executive said she was going to go ahead anyway. There were more demonstrations. She announced she was suspending it. And another 2 million people marched to make sure she got the message. And Okay. I was not here for that. That was where I really began to get big. I came shortly afterward. I was here when an estimated 1.7 million people marched in August. And I can tell you what that was like.
Yes.
It was this absolute determination by an enormous number of people. You know, it's a colony, former colony of 7.5 million people. When you get more than a million, you know, you're approaching a quarter of the population is what happened with the 2 million person march, close to it with 1.7 million. And they came out despite the fears that China had just been threatening Hong Kong. If the demonstrations continued, if they carried on with what China regards as breaking the law, with fire and the abyss. I mean, literally in those terms, the spokesman for the office that handles Hong Kong and Macau affairs in Beijing had threatened those who play with fire will perish by it, that Hong Kong was, and so on. And there had just been a video circulated on the internet of Chinese, the People's Armed Police, which basically are complement to the complement with an E, they're another arm of military force to the PLA, had been drilling, practicing with people speaking Cantonese, which is the dialect in Hong Kong, not in the mainland where they speak Mandarin. It was a very pointed threat. In fact, Beijing had been threatening quite specifically that it had every right to intervene with the People's Liberation Army in Hong Kong if it wanted to, if it felt it was necessary, and so on. If the chief executive invited them in, well, since she's appointed by Beijing and basically, you know, serves them, it would not be hard if they wanted her to invite them. So you had all these threats. Everybody was worried. And Hong Kong's people turned out. They just didn't just turn out in the sweltering heat. I mean, August here is a steam bath. This is semi-tropics. With their children, they came into staggering numbers. The government, the police had forbidden them to march the route they usually take from this big park called Victoria Park to the central business district. They were told they could only have a rally. They had to stay in the park. Well, they filled up the park and spilled over. So many people came that they began marching by default. They were marching simply because they were trying to get into the park. And then along came this huge cloudburst. There was this tremendous rainstorm and everybody got soaked. It was miserable. Okay, they were all standing there with their umbrellas. You couldn't get anywhere because there were so many people. The streets were jammed. The police, who turn up in full riot gear when they want to finally do something, were nowhere to be seen in the role they should be playing to just help sort out the traffic. And finally, these protesters, in their enormous numbers, began marching along the route that they were forbidden to take. They did it peacefully. They did it in such huge numbers that they occupied the roads. But it was a massive portion of the population. The government's complaint the next day was that they had inconvenienced traffic. What I witnessed was that traffic was inconveniencing this staggeringly large protest of people who had stuck it out through the heat, through the rain, who were determined to get their message across. The administration they're dealing with here is equally determined not to actually hear it. Their message being that they want free elections, basically.
Right. Yeah, the demands have grown from the original anti-extradition. But to many people, it seems that China has opened up in many ways, liberalized, if you will, allowing people to go into business, allowing them to travel overseas, welcoming more tourists and business people to come to China. And you write, the truth is that for all China's economic advances, it remains a brutal, dehumanizing tyranny in which the ruling Communist Party would rather destroy people than give them a genuine say in their government. How do both of these situations exist together?
Because China's ruling Communist Party, which isn't really communist anymore. I mean, it was a collectivist Communist Party when Mao took power in 1949. It has evolved into it's a sort of techno-surveillance tyranny at this point, maintaining a lot of the structures of the Communist Party, but allowing enough latitude in the economic sphere for people to make money. In other words, you are allowed to do things that will make you personally rich if you can find ways, which you were not allowed to do under Mao's communism unless you were one of his buddies in the party. And actually, that's sort of the way it still works. But if you raise your head to say anything critical of the government, if you object in any way that doesn't suit the overlords, you are toast. You have no recourse. There is no real system of justice. There are no elections where people can decide we're going to change our leadership as we want it to be. There's nothing like that. So what China is today is unfortunately still a terrible tyranny with a prison, dissident prison camp system and all that stuff, surveillance state. But it's economically more efficient than it was under communism, therefore more dangerous, really, because they have more resources to spend on things like the growing military, which they're going to put on display next Tuesday at their 70th anniversary of their founding as a communist state, with a huge military parade touting their nuclear arsenal through Tiananmen Square. I never really was a subscriber to the idea that China was on a huge reform roll. They would do some things that opened the economy enough so the party could benefit. And in order for the party to benefit, they had to allow people to make more money. And that also kept people somewhat happier. The thing about human nature is people want more than material goods. They want life to mean something, and they want dignity, which you really only get when you're free. And one of the reasons they have this huge surveillance state in China and the People's Armed Police and the prisons and all the rest of that is I don't think the Chinese people are terribly happy with the system they've got either. But the penalty for saying that is so huge. Very few dare to risk it. And that's what horrified the people of Hong Kong when they saw that with this extradition bill, they might be coming under that system much sooner than the promised 50 years of the grace period that came with the British handoff. That's when they began these enormous marches.
We've just got a few minutes left, so let's do a quick kind of lightning round on a couple of things. About their involvement? We know about their stealing intellectual property, but what about their involvement in the U.S., in Hollywood, in universities? It feels like, in other words, while they have this one face of liberalizing and opening up, but you're describing the reality of what it's like. How concerned should we be about their invasion, so to speak, subversion into Silicon Valley and Hollywood and academia in this country?
Very concerned. Look, if China had become a democracy, as Taiwan has done, as Hong Kong is fully capable of doing, if they were the leading edge of what's going on in China, and unfortunately they are not, I'd say fine, great, invest in Hollywood, do whatever, it's fine. But China is run by a ruling Communist Party under the current president, Xi Jinping, whose ambition is that China shall become the dominant world power. And to that end, he's got access to enormous resources because the state really decides, controls things when they want to. Okay, you have latitude to do business, but the state can step in at any point to say, we want you to do the following. So you have a strategic vision aimed at world dominance from the top, which can move around resources as the ruler wishes. And that's where a lot of these investments that they've been making are not great investments. You know, their Belt and Road has probably not been wonderful economically, but as far as lending all this money to develop ports in places along a road where they aspire to sort of become the dominant power. But their good investments, if what China is after, is future military bases, access to try to influence other governments. They're a good investment in that sense. In other words, for the average person in China, it's not a good use of money. But for Xi Jinping, for the Communist Party, it is a useful investment. It's a predatory power. So we should be quite concerned.
So one final question. How would you rank the threats that they pose in terms of military to both us and the region, as an economic threat and as a subversive threat? In other words, for instance, we found out that Dianne Feinstein had a Chinese spy in her midst for a number of years. She was chairman of the Senate Intelligence Committee. So,
yeah, that's not a good sign.
but ranking the threats, military, economic, subversion, how would you to line those up?
I wouldn't actually rank them because I think they're pretty well integrated in China. Again, remember that they don't actually have an independent economic sector. It all tracks back to the state. Yep. Even when somebody runs a factory, if the government says, we need you to do the following, even if it's not in your economic interest, he'd better toe the line or he will be in trouble and there is no independent judiciary. He has no place to go unless he flees the country. I think the worries are, look, as far as economic, it's a very broad category. If we're talking about things like trade, I don't see great harm in buying Chinese unmanufactured undershirts. Okay, that, you know, they're cheaper. It is good for American consumers. The problem is how to separate out that from things that end up serving strategic purposes for them. When we start doing business, for instance, in the communications high tech sector, the kind of problem that we run into with Huawei. And separating those out is a pretty tough problem. So I think to try and do everything, sort of sort out all the economic dilemmas purely in the economic realm is really hard. What you need is to back it up with military deterrence against China harboring too great an ambition to lord it over the free world. Basically, they'd be happy to have the free world go away. It's a threat to the leadership of China. Because people in China, it's the problem that Hong Kong poses for Beijing right now. People in China see that there are other ways to do things, and it does look attractive. I don't buy it that they love the system they have. If they loved it so much, there wouldn't be all that security keeping an eye on them all the time, or the prisons for when they do things the government doesn't want. So the thing that I find perhaps most important to keep in mind overall is I talk with people, especially from the American military side, who are concerned, people whose opinions and information, basically background I respect. They're concerned that out there somewhere is the next Pearl Harbor, only it won't be Japan, it'll be China. And it won't be Pearl Harbor, because the thing about Pearl Harbor is that you don't see it coming. But with what's going on in the cyber realms, with the Chinese military buildup, with the islands that they've been building in the South China Sea and topping with military bases, there's a lot to worry about there. That's huge ambition. And again, it's huge ambition in the hands of a predatory tyranny in centuries past that has led to terrible wars. So military deterrence on our part matters a lot. And it sort of should stand behind whatever we're doing with trade and the economy. As far as subversion, I guess if it looks too good to be true, you better take a closer look. And, I think, again, it's hard to winnow out. But before a university takes a whacking enormous pile of money from China, the question should be, what does China think it's buying? Likewise, pretty much any American enterprise. The question to be asking is, why would China be doing this?
Our guest today has been Claudia Rosette, one of the truly great independent journalists out there. You won't find many people telling this version of what's going on, the truth of what's going on there in Hong Kong and China today. Claudia, what is the best way people can follow you or find your articles?
Thank you. On the website for the Independent Women's Forum, IWF.org, really simple. Go there, and my articles and things like this interview are posted there. And I also write for PJ Media at the Rosette Report. So between those, you'll get, because I sort of put things out all over the place. I do write freelance, but you'll find most of them there. Again, IWF.org and PJ Media.
Okay, well, I want to thank you and wish you safe travels and
keep
up the great work, and look forward to communicating with you in the future. Thanks so
much. Thank you,
Doctor. Okay. Take care.
You too.
All right. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Continuing on our show today, our next guest is Melanie Phillips. Melanie is a British journalist, broadcaster, and author. Her weekly column, which currently appears in the Times of London, has been published over the years in The Guardian, Observer, Sunday Times, and Daily Mail. She also writes for the Jewish Chronicle and Jewish News Syndicate. She is a regular panelist on BBC Radio's The Moral Maze, speaks on public platforms throughout the English-speaking world.
Welcome, Melanie, to the Aronoff Report.
Hello, Roger. Good to speak to you again.
Thank you. Great to have you. I want to tell them more about you before we get started. Her best-selling book, Londonistan, about the British establishment's capitulation to Islamist aggression, was published in 2006 by Encounter, New York. She followed this in 2010 with The World Turned Upside Down, The Global Battle Over God, Truth, and Power, with a foreword by David Mamet. An updated paperback edition of Guardian Angel, her personal and political memoir, was published in the U.S. by Bombardier in January 2018. Her first novel, The Legacy, was published also by Bombardier in April of 2018. And you can follow Melanie's work at melaniephillips.com, on Twitter at @MelanieLatest, or on Facebook at facebook.com/MelanieLatest. So I want to talk to you about your books and articles, but first, let's talk a little about the Israeli election. News is just breaking as we go on the air that Israeli President Reuven Rivlin has tapped Prime Minister Bibi Netanyahu to form a new government. And putting together a government in Israel has become like working a Rubik's Cube. Clearly, the Likud and the Blue and White were unable to reach an agreement on a unity government. And yesterday it appeared that both parties wanted the other one to go first, meaning that they would have 42 days to put together a coalition equaling 61 members out of a 120-member Knesset. That didn't happen, and so the party with the fewer elected members of the Knesset, which is unusual, is being given the first crack at it. So please explain to our audience what is going on here and what you see as the likely outcome.
Well, I'm not an expert on Israeli politics, and in many respects I find it as baffling as anybody. But as far as I can see, what's happening is this, that although Mr. Netanyahu, as you said, has fewer seats than Benny Gantz's Blue and White party, President Rivlin obviously thinks that Mr. Netanyahu has a better chance of forming a coalition. As far as I can see, Mr. Gantz has virtually no chance of forming a coalition. Now, it's possible that Netanyahu will not be able to form a coalition, in which case he could ask for an extension. But it's also possible that Speaker Rivlin, that President Rivlin, will say that's enough. You've had your chance. And then it's up to President Rivlin to go back to Benny Gantz. I think that even so, Mr. Gantz will still not be able to form a coalition. The president could ask anyone in the Knesset to try and form a government, but no one is likely to be able to do so. So it is very possible that Israel's long-suffering public will face the nightmare scenario of yet a third general election in quick succession at the end of this year or the beginning of next year.
Well, that it certainly looks like a possibility. A couple of other factors, you know, is the Arab coalition of 13, which is now the third largest party, but there's never been a coalition with them because for the most part they speak openly about being against the existence of the State of Israel. And then you have the factor of Avigdor Lieberman, who has 9 members, and he doesn't seem to want to do a coalition with either party for different reasons. So, one theory that I've heard is that perhaps Netanyahu could, since he has 55 solid, needing 61, maybe he could peel off some of Lieberman's people. You know, they're free to break off, I guess, if they want to. And so it appears that Bibi has a much better chance of putting together a government than Gantz.
Well, I guess that's why President Rivlin has gone to Netanyahu, who has a reputation over the years of being a kind of magician in conjuring up coalitions out of apparently impossible scenarios. And that may well happen again. The Arab joint list, as you say, has never been part of any governing body, any governing coalition in Israel. And that's largely because they've always decided that they don't want to be part of the government. And the joint list has again said that although it nominated Gantz, It would not join a coalition because it's against what Gantz stands for, which is basically the continuation of the State of Israel, which is right. Basically what the joint list is against. So why did they vote for Gantz? Why did they nominate Gantz? One reason only, as they said, to get rid of Netanyahu. And it's a curious and a rather disturbing fact that the one unifying factor between all these different bodies jostling for power, blue and white, the Arab List, and even parts of the Likud, they all want to get rid of Netanyahu. And he's determined to be going nowhere.
Well, that's true, and it's kind of odd in the sense that he seems to have been so successful as prime minister, both in security and in the economy, and look, building alliances around the world with not just obviously his famously close relationship with Trump, but with India. And, you know, there's sort of this off-the-books alliance of Israel, Saudi Arabia, Egypt, and others, other Gulf states that are fearful of Iran and their growing power and influence in the area. So you would think with all that going for him, this would have been a fairly easy re-election for him. But, of course, he's got the so-called corruption issues that are kind of hanging over his head. I mean, what do you see as the reasons why he didn't get easily reelected?
I think people have been extremely put out by the corruption thing. I think they were extremely put out by the fact that he wanted to change the law in order to avoid, in order to indemnify himself. This goes against people's innate sense of, you know, justice needing to take its course. Whether or not these charges are trumped up against him is not the point. Due process must be followed. And I think people very much think that. Mm-hmm. Another factor which counted against him, I think, is that even among fairly religious Israelis, let alone the secular bloc, there is a real dismay and exasperation with the power wielded by the ultra-Orthodox, with whom Netanyahu has an iron pact. It is the ultra-Orthodox who've basically kept him in power. And people believe that the price that they've had, that they've required him to pay, is just appalling. All this mucking around with the draft, for example, trying to get out of that, and all kinds of stuff. And you know, the ultra-Orthodox world has been wagging the less orthodox and secular dog for a very long time, and people are just fed up with it. They're fed up with the behaviour of the ultra-Orthodox and the fact they're holding government after government to ransom. So those are two factors which counted against him. Then it's his personal style, bombastic, arrogant, and there's a feeling that, you know, his achievements are many, and few would disagree that, you know, in the field of foreign affairs, he is second to none in his strategic grasp of the challenges facing Israel, the changing nature of the Arab world, the new opportunities around the world, and so on. But nevertheless, I think people feel, you know, enough. He's been in power too long, and it's starting to show. They want, you know, no one is infallible, and he's getting a kind of, I don't know, a kind of Napoleonic image of somebody who is, you know, accruing more and more power to himself. I mean, you know, he's in the last administration, he was his own minister of this and that, as well as being prime minister. And people are fed up with that.
So it sounds like you think, and a lot of people do, because they can't see either of these people forming, either party forming a coalition with 61. And if they couldn't put a unity coalition together, and we head to a third election, why would we think this is going to be a different result the third time? And then what?
Well, indeed. Yeah. But I suppose, as one of the more famous characters in Dickens, Charles Dickens' novels, said, something will turn up. It's that sort of belief, you know. If you sort of push it down the line a bit, well, something will turn up, something will change, possibly, and then, well, you know, then we'll have a coalition.
Which clashes with the Einstein, the definition of insanity is trying the same thing and thinking you're going to have a different result.
This is also very true.
So, one more thing about the Labour Party, which was dominant for so many years, is now almost out of existence.
Yes. Well, that's because I mean, ever since the debacle over the Oslo agreement,
right.
The Labour Party has had no credible song to sing. It's stuck on the same old song of two-state solution, you know, make compromises with people who do not want to make compromises because they have an unconscionable agenda of exterminating you. And, you know, people have been through, you know, thousands of deaths in Israel as a result of Oslo, and they won't have it anymore. They want peace like anybody else, but they don't want to be dead. And, you know, the left is still stuck in this groove, and until and unless the left becomes realistic, it's over. So all these things we've just been talking about, you know, the difficulties of forming a coalition and a functioning government, are all basically people who are broadly on the same side of that particular argument, but who fall out over other things.
And finally, on this topic, has the relationship with Trump had any downside for Bibi, or has it been mostly positive for, you know, I guess it hasn't helped him get reelected, but how has that worked out? Obviously, for many American Jews and people, happy to see the U.S. embassy move to Jerusalem and the other things that Trump has done with the Golan Heights and really worked very closely with Bibi. Has that helped Bibi or hurt him back home, you think?
I'm not really sure it's done either, quite honestly. Uh-huh. I mean, people are, they're aware of the relationship. They're grateful for it. They're pleased that, you know, America is smiling upon Israel. But Trump is a very polarizing figure, as you know. Right. And a lot of Israelis hate Netanyahu because he is Trump's friend. So it plays that way as well. And among the people for whom the opposite applies, the people who, like Trump, believe he's a great friend of Israel and the Jewish people and appreciate the relationship with Netanyahu, I think probably they think that the relationship with Israel would survive Netanyahu's going. In other words, Trump's affection for Israel does not depend on Netanyahu.
One more thing before we go to your books, and that is on British politics. What is going on with Brexit in view of the court's ruling this week that Boris Johnson didn't have the right to end Parliament session as he did? We're less than a month away from the Brexit date. What do you expect to happen? What do you want to happen? Give us your take on this story.
Well, first of all, no one knows what's going to happen. And anyone who tells you what's going to happen in the next hour in Britain is not telling the truth. It is an unprecedented situation. The Supreme Court's decision has precipitated what was already the worst crisis in British history, I would say, since the 17th century Civil War when the king was executed.
Wow.
It's promoted that into a raging constitutional crisis, and that's because of this fact that I'm speaking as a very, very strong Brexiteer, and from my point of view and the point of view of the 17.5 million people who voted Brexit in the referendum in 2016, and also a large number of people who voted to remain, they are all beyond horrified, and it's impossible to exaggerate the fury over the fact that you have a situation in Britain where the majority of members of Parliament are for Remain, despite the fact that they often represent constituents or constituencies which voted Brexit. Now, what's been happening with ever-increasing and extraordinary and unprecedented frequency is that the members of Parliament, the backbench members of Parliament, aided by an extremely partisan and out-of-order Speaker of the House of Commons, the guy whose position is supposed to police the House of Commons and enforce its rule, that Speaker is a convinced Remainer, and he has basically allowed backbench members of Parliament to tear up the Constitution. We don't have a written constitution in Britain, but nevertheless, there is a constitution. There are established principles and precedents going back centuries about the conduct of government. So the Speaker has allowed members of Parliament to tear up the constitution, tear up the rules of parliament in order to enable them to seize power from the government. Technically, they've seized what's called the order paper, which means that members of parliament can pass laws which the government doesn't agree to. Now, this basically paralyzes government. It's against every constitutional principle. And it's meant that Boris Johnson, the Prime Minister, has become a prisoner of the House of Commons. In order to stop members of parliament from mucking around any more and preventing Brexit from happening without a withdrawal deal, if necessary, on October the 31st. That's why the Prime Minister prorogued Parliament. Proroguing is a way of saying it dismisses Parliament for a kind of recess. Technically, it's done by the Queen in Parliament, but on the advice of the Prime Minister. And what happened this week was that Remainers, determined to stop Brexit, took a case to court, and it finally got to the Supreme Court, in which they argued that the Prime Minister had not been entitled to prorogue Parliament. And to everyone's absolute shock, all 11 justices of the Supreme Court agreed. Now, why there was such shock was that it has been, until this week, an absolutely iron principle that the courts do not get involved in politics. Unlike America, we don't have politicized judges. We don't have a political Supreme Court. We don't have elected judges. We have a complete separation between the judiciary and the government, or government and parliament. And what's happened this week is that the Supreme Court has made an enormous leap into parliamentary procedure, into politics, on the most contentious issue in living memory. And as a result, it's plunged Britain into a complete constitutional crisis. So there's that level of what's gone on. Plus, it has actually brought Parliament back. Parliament returned today, and there is now more time for members of Parliament to make merry mischief again in order to stop Brexit. Now, They may succeed. We don't know what's going to happen. The Prime Minister has run out of rope. He's effectively being held hostage in the House of Commons by members of Parliament. But if Brexit is stopped, if the British people perceive, as they are perceiving, that a Remainer House of Commons has set itself against the people in order to thwart the fulfilment of the biggest popular vote ever in the 2016 referendum to leave the European Union, then when there is eventually a general election, which incidentally the MPs are preventing Boris Johnson from calling because they know that they're going to go down in flame, when there is a general election, the British public will almost certainly take its revenge on all these establishment politicians who stop Brexit. So it's impossible to exaggerate the degree of chaos, the sense of crisis, the sense of despair, and the fury and emotion which is now has become the substitute for government in Britain.
Well, is it the case that if there is no majority in Parliament for any particular decision, which I believe is what happened several times with Theresa May, kept trying to put forth one plan or another, and they couldn't get a majority for anything. So if they still can't get a majority for anything, does the no-deal Brexit automatically take place on October 31st, or is there another way to defer it?
Well, that's the point. As things stand, it is the law. Britain leaves on October 31st. It leaves by default with no deal, if no deal has been arrived at.
Right.
That was the legislation passed by the Remainer House of Commons. However, it's become obvious that they will stop at nothing to stop this, and that aided by this very partisan speaker, they're basically making up the rules and destroying the rules as they go along. So what the Remainer MPs are now busy doing is working out strategies in order to stop Brexit. We don't know how. Maybe there's wild talk of installing a different prime minister. Quite how they do that is not entirely clear to me, not clear at all. There's wild talk also of passing all kinds of different types of laws which will stop Brexit. What they're frightened to do is the thing that if they were honest they would do, because what they want to do is to stop Brexit. They don't just want not to leave with no withdrawal deal, which is their official position. What they actually want to do is to stop Brexit altogether. And however, they don't have the honesty and the decency and the courage to do what they should do if they want to stop Brexit, which is to repeal the act that they passed, which brings Britain out. It's called triggering Article 50, but basically it's the law which was agreed with the European Union, and that brings Britain out. And they could repeal it, but they won't. So they are doing everything they can to stop it without being seen to stop it. And we don't know what ruses they have up their sleeve.
Fascinating. Well, let's move on to your book. First, let's start with Guardian Angel. Mm-hmm. My Journey from Leftism to Sanity. I love the title. So tell us why you wrote this and tell us about your journey.
Well, I wrote it in order to establish where I was coming from, because I arouse a great deal of controversy in Britain because, as the book details, I worked for about 20 years for Guardian newspapers. The Guardian is even more left-wing than the New York Times, and I was part of that whole setup. And the story in Guardian Angel is how I gradually realized that everything that I thought they stood for was the opposite. In other words, I thought they all stood for truth against lies, victim against oppressor, justice against injustice, and so on. And in fact, I came to realize they stood for almost in every area of public policy, they actually stood for the opposite. And it was a long and slow realization. That was because I regarded them as kind of my family, and it was like a terrible divorce. And they've never forgiven me for moving in the way that I did, because I haven't actually moved what I believe in. I still believe in truth against lies and justice against injustice and victim against oppressor. I just now have come to the realization that the people on the left were on the side of injustice and oppression, not the other side. And so they never forgiven me for it. So I wrote the book, the memoir, to explain why I'd progressed in the way that I had, in order to show that I'm the same person, and in order to explain quite why I reacted in the way that I did to all these things, it was necessary to put in a certain amount of personal stuff about my own personal family background.
Okay, so was there a moment of epiphany, or you said gradual, but was there a particular issue that brought it home to you more than anything else?
No, I mean it started a long time back in 1982 when I realized that there was a problem at the Guardian about attitudes to Israel and Jews, and that's when I first realized there was something very wrong with their worldview. And then I became an op-ed columnist in the late 80s, in 1987, and at that stage I started writing stuff which seemed to me to be just writing about reality and the truth as I saw it and what was actually going on in the fields of education, family breakdown, multiculturalism. And on every single one of these issues, I fell out with my colleagues who made my life a misery, basically, as a result. And gradually, I put all this together. And the point about writing the memoir, Guardian Angel, is that through the personal story of my coming to realize of my fighting these particular battles issue by issue, and then coming to realize that they weren't separate issues, that they were all part of the same story, through telling my personal story of all that, I also tell the story of what's happened to the West, which has descended into this cultural chaos in which it no longer knows what it stands for, and it doesn't like what it should be standing for, and it wants to make itself into something completely different. And it ended up fracturing itself into identity politics and the production of hatred and intolerance and the suppression of free speech, all masquerading as the opposite. It's a completely upside-down situation. I know that from first hand because that's what happened to me.
Well, and you may recall, I interviewed you once before about 9 years ago about your book, World Turned Upside Down. So I know we talked about that, and yes, it did. And speaking, you know, of the Jewish aspect of it.
Yes.
Even in this country, you know, in America, it's probably 75% of American Jews vote Democrat.
Sure.
And even with the relationship that Trump has brought to with Israel compared to Obama's, and you have in today's Democratic Party people like Ilhan Omar and Rashida Tlaib have a very comfortable home in the Democratic Party. Co-chairman of the party was Keith Ellison, again someone close with
Louis Farrakhan.
Yeah, with Muslim Brotherhood and CARE. So but it doesn't seem to make much of a difference. I'm wondering with Jeremy Corbyn, whose anti-Semitism is even more pronounced. I don't know more, but very pronounced and very clear to many people. The Jewish population in England, are they primarily Labour or Conservative at this point?
They are not Labour. They are mainly Conservative voters, but they're very concerned, obviously, about Jeremy Corbyn coming to power. And in the chaos of Brexit, that becomes ever more likely.
Yeah, wow. Well, so your other book, which is your first novel called Legacy, The Legacy, sounds to me, I haven't read it, but from reading about it, it sounds like it might have been influenced by the Da Vinci Code and the Dead Sea Scrolls. That's what I was thinking when I was reading about it. Tell us about your protagonist, Russell Wolff.
Well, the protagonist is a typical person of a certain kind in Britain, a British Jew who doesn't want to be a Jew, who is ashamed of being a Jew and embarrassed by it, a secular person, a left-wing person, who's bought into all of that without really thinking about it. And the story that I invented brings him into uncomfortable contact with the history of his people, and it basically sucks him in, and it changes him, not completely, but it changes him enough for him to realize much more about what he's missed and what he's lost, and what he actually is. And it's a wide canvas. It covers contemporary Britain. It covers contemporary anti-Semitism in Britain. It covers the contemporary existential uncertainty of a certain type of British Jew. But it also goes back in history into the Middle Ages in Britain, into Holocaust Poland, and into modern Israel. So it's a it's a fairly wide canvas, and what I was trying to bring out in this novel is that we can't escape the pull of history. We can't escape what we are, and history pulls us in, it's what forms us. And we deny it. If we deny it, we deny something that's important about us, especially if we are Jews. And I also wanted to get inside the head of an anti-Semite, and I wanted to explore the continuity of anti-Jewish feeling down through the centuries. So it's quite an ambitious novel. People tell me it's a page turner, which is very gratifying. It was published in America last year. Unfortunately, it's had no reviews because not many people know about it, and that's a source of some grief. But there you go. Publishing is a strange business. But it's available on Amazon, as is Guardian Angel. Anyone can buy it from there.
Well, it might have something to do with your politics that it doesn't get reviewed and, you know, get written about in the New York Times and all that.
Yes, might, well, quite.
Yeah. So we're running out of time, but I'd like one more thing, the Londonistan update. You know, I think of that when I think about what led to Brexit. A big part of that, in my mind, correct me if I'm wrong, is, you know, the immigration policy that the EU brought on, Angela Merkel and all that, and just said people, you know, which you wrote about so beautifully about Londonistan, about what was happening regarding, I guess, Muslim immigration into England and all that. So since you published that book, how have things gone in that direction, in that area?
It's not really changed, except that it's got worse. It's got worse and better in certain respects. There's been a certain amount more realism by government, but not much. Basically, they don't want to take on what is an increasingly large minority community, which is increasingly electorally powerful. So the kind of appeasement of Islamization, which is what I was talking about, is going on. But there are other things going on as well. There's a development of, especially among the young, a significant Muslim, secular Muslim class, which, you know, they are British and they want to be British. And I think people in America don't really understand and don't really want to understand that it's not right or proper or accurate to lump all Muslims together. There is a very, very significant problem of a lack of Muslim integration and Muslim extremism in Britain, no question about it. But it's very important to understand there are many Muslims who are equally opposed to all this. You say that it was a major factor behind Brexit. I disagree. That's how people who oppose Brexit are casting it. They cast people who have voted for Brexit as being racist, Islamophobic, xenophobic, narrow-minded, backward bigots. But it's not true. The main reason for Brexit was the deep, deep, deep British desire engraved in its DNA for independence, to rule itself as a national, for its parliament to have sovereignty, so that it passes laws which can't be overturned by a foreign court, which is the situation at the moment. The European Court of Justice has priority over a British court. In other words, Britain is not an independent nation. Now, in Britain, an island nation for hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of years, which has repelled all invaders for 1,000 years, it goes very, very deep. Britons have paid in blood over the centuries for this independence. They understand better than anyone in the world what a nation is. And they aren't going to give it up. And they did give it up because they had very little choice all those years ago in the 70s when they were taken into the European Union or its precursor. But ever since, feeling has been building enormously. We don't control our own laws. So, yes, there is great concern about mass immigration. There was particular concern 3 years ago because that was the time when Angela Merkel said famously, "The wissen das, let them all in," and so on. And people in Britain were very concerned about that. And it was high up on the agenda. But it was outweighed by, as they've always said, all opinion polls have said, have shown, that the main reason for voting for Brexit was to be able to rule ourselves again. That was what was so important. They wanted, you know, the people of Britain want to be able to set their own immigration policy, and they want to be able to rule themselves in every other aspect of their lives. It's the sort of thing that you in America take for granted. You are a sovereign nation. Britain is not, and it needs to be again. And that's why there is such fury now about the Remainer MPs thwarting this, because it's a very bitter argument. You know, what is democracy? These are members of parliament who've been elected through a democratic process. As far as they're concerned, the Remainer MPs, they're fighting for democracy. They're fighting for parliament to have its say. But for the public point of view, this is parliament setting itself against the people. You know, I said it earlier on, it was the worst constitutional crisis since the Civil War of the 17th century. And in that Civil War, what happened then was that you had the forces of Parliament versus the King. The King's despotic power was challenged by Parliament. They executed the King. And on the basis of what then happened, that laid the foundations of what we now have, which is a parliamentary democracy and a constitutional monarchy. And what's happening now, what was going on then was Parliament against the monarch. What's happening now is Parliament against the people, which is unconscionable. And I can't describe to you the level of grief and anguish and fury that this is causing. And it is, and the worst of it is, as you were suggesting earlier, there's no easy way through this, because the thing is stuck. It is an impasse in Parliament. Neither side will yield to the other. Both are stuck with each other, and nobody knows how it's going to end.
Our guest today has been Melanie Phillips. Brilliant as always. Her books are wonderful. Her articles, I've been reading them for years. I urge you to get her newest books, Guardian Angel and the Legacy, and go back, read Lamdunistan. It's a classic, world turned upside down. Go visit her website, melaniephillips.com. You can follow her on Twitter, at melanielatest, or on Facebook, facebook.com/melanielatest. Melanie, it's been an honor and a great having you on here again, and look forward to staying in touch with you, and thank you so much, and we'll just sign off there. I think we've reached our time limit, and Melanie...
Okay, thank you for having me, Roger. It's been great.
Okay, terrific. Take care. Bye-bye.
Bye.